Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our Joint Committee on Transportation this February 19th, 2018. We have an agenda this evening that includes two areas that we are going to touch on: vehicle privilege tax and electric vehicle rebate programs. But before we do that, I have a couple of announcements I'd like to make. First of all, I'd like to welcome Representative Vial. He is now an official member of our committee. He was replaced at the speaker's request this afternoon, and we're delighted to have him here. I want to thank the representative for being so consummately well prepared with all of the hours that you have put into this on your own time. And we're very grateful to have you with us.
Thanks.
Consummately, okay.
And
what
I
was
also
that, Olson?
I probably didn't want to hear.
I wouldn't go there.
It's a thick broth, Madam Chair.
It's a thick broth. Thank you. And I think Representative Olson's had something he wanted to touch on as we open the committee hearing today.
Hey, thanks, Madam Chair, and committee members. Just really quick, I submitted and actually had crafted the amendments for -9-13. Just want you to know that I'm not planning on introducing those. I feel that's probably best to move forward with what the administrative rules are that Department of Transportation has moved forward with for the intermodal hub decision for location, and play it out that way.
Great.
That's it.
Thank you. We have a public hearing scheduled for House Bill 4060. Many of you have been watching as this process has unfolded. We will have this hearing tonight on these two subject areas. On Wednesday, we will have a hearing and actually go through the sections of the bill that are areas that we want to discuss for drafting into an amendment. We want to move that amendment out of this committee on Monday, so we're on a fairly tight turnaround. I would also like to let our committee members know there was an email sent out today with a matrix of the areas of that we have discussed so far, and that will include tonight's. And we would like to have you go through that, mark it up, get it back to your chair by tomorrow, 4 o'clock. So that we can then put together our process for Wednesday night, where we will actually go through section by section areas that are still standing. Senator Johnson.
There seems to be two copies of this list.
And I will turn to Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that list that's before you on the dais that I set out on the dais tonight is a slightly revised. I sent the one out earlier today before it was completely done at the co-chair's request, but the one at the dais and the one I'm about to send to all the members of the committee electronically has just a couple additions that were not in the version that went out earlier today.
So for those of us that don't see a date or a time on here, one of them ends with section 5659 and one of them ends with section 58, which is the operative list. On page one.
So the new version of it is section, we'll have section 58 at the bottom of page.
Okay.
Okay.
So it is.
Got it. I get to redo this all over.
They both have the same date, but let's put a timestamp at the top.
Yep.
The correct version ends with section 58 at the bottom of page one. Is everybody clear? All right, that is the document.
All right. I'm so excited I'll get my red ink pen and put more nose on.
Karen, you're in my comments, too. Assuming I'm getting those, but you
on that note,
they would be interested.
I'm going to go ahead, Patrick, and open our public hearing.
I'm just writing down here so I can look at it.
On House Bill 4060. And turn to Patrick to give us a little bit of an update on what we're talking about tonight. We have two issues under discussion.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So the topics for discussion tonight will be the sections of the measure dealing with the vehicle privilege tax. There is currently nothing in either 4059 or 4060 dealing with those. There were a lot of questions to be answered. I believe that people will be testifying in support of certain concepts for possible amendments to the bill tonight, Madam Chair. And based on those comments, I believe, and the response of the committee to those, that's what will be considered when we go to Wednesday night for the privilege tax. As far as the second piece, the electric vehicle rebate programs are in sections 29 through 32 of House Bill 4060. Those are some proposed amendments to those programs. There may be some comments for people that are in support or in opposition to those suggested amendments, or there may be people that have suggestions that are not encapsulated in either 4059 or 4060.
So suggestions for consideration.
So probably taking them in the order in which we're going, if we're going to do that, Madam Chair, we'll start with that.
Okay, so I have three people signed up to speak to the vehicle privilege tax.
Yes. And Madam Chair.
Oh, wait a minute, keep going. Where are we? Oh, first panel.
Yeah.
One more, okay, got it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer, certainly.
Yes, just to clarify, people, because of Senator DeBoer's expertise in this area, he's been very helpful to DOR and others in trying to put this in logical. And I did ask him if he would attend tonight and help us with any questions or anything that might come up on the electric vehicle and privilege tax.
Senator DeBoer, thank you for taking the time to be here tonight. I thought what we would do is let the four people that would are signed up to be witnesses tonight speak, and then we would open up for questions from the panel, and I'm delighted to have you here as a resource, sir, as we move forward.
Thank you.
Great. So thank you for joining us tonight. Let's do two panels of two. Mr. Perry and Mr. Remsberger, please. Good evening, gentlemen.
Can we have the three of us come to the table?
Sure. Then I guess we'll have Daryl all by himself. Mr. Emerson. Welcome. Thank you for being here tonight.
Chair Beyer, Chair McCune. Bill Perry with the Oregon Auto Dealers. I'll just basically kind of kick this off and let the experts talk about it. But yeah, the three main issues we're going to be talking about is the trailer issue, and then how leases are dealt with, and the cabin chassis, which is described as is going to be like if you buy a cabin chassis, you put a ambulance, a tow truck, all those kind of things on the backside of it. That's an aftermarket. So with that, and then I'll let Mr. Remsberger introduce who the FAR person is on the panel,
thank
too.
You.
So,
welcome, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chair Beyer. For the record, my name is Greg Remsberger. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Oregon Automobile Dealers Association, and I appreciate your time during this short session to address these issues. I have worked closely with the Department of Revenue and was part of drafting the language on the privilege tax when it was originally being written. So I think just from implementation over the last month and a half with our dealers, I think I know this fairly well. And there's a few things that have come up that we wanted to address. As Bill said, there were three issues: the trailer issue, calculation of the tax on a leased vehicle, and then the amount taxed on a medium-duty truck. I have two people with me, Don Emerson, who is the owner of Fleet Maintenance, Inc. He owns several different medium-duty truck dealerships here in Oregon, so I'm going to have him address that issue. And being that it was President's Day and my daughter was off of school, I brought my daughter along to experience a little bit about what legislation is about. And she also wanted to point out how smart her father was and that all of you should pay attention to everything that I say.
Very important. Thank you for being here.
So first, I want to talk about the trailer issue. The privilege tax is charged on new vehicles, and a new vehicle by definition is something that has 7,500 miles on it or less. A trailer doesn't have an odometer, so it's outside of when it's originally sold. There's no way of telling whether it's considered a new vehicle when it's resold a separate time around. The Department of Revenue has talked about only charging on trailers when an MSO, which is a manufacturer's statement of origin, or an MCO, a certificate of origin, are issued, and that's fine. Our preference would be just to eliminate trailers altogether. And an example I'll give of that is when you sell a boat, a boat is not charged the tax because it's not destined to go on the road, but the trailer is. So when you look at the work that would be required to go out and track with all the boat dealers when they sold a trailer and do an audit through each one of those, the cost on that is far going to exceed what the trailer revenue would come out of that side of it. It's also our opinion that the just in the vehicle, the car sales and light-duty truck sales, not including the medium-duty trucks and other things that qualify for the privilege tax, that the revenue generated by the privilege tax is going to far exceed the $24 million that is needed to feed both the EV incentive and the Charge Ahead program, which are $12 million apiece. I was hoping to be able to get my hands on the first month sales so I could come in and calculate that based on what average car sale was, a number of cars sold in that category, but they typically run a month behind, and I was on the phone earlier today with Polk and with our statistician trying to get that information, but was unable to because it was President's Day. Just so that we're clear, by ORS 801.560, a definition of a trailer means a vehicle without motive power designed to be drawn by another trailer, by another vehicle. So again, what I think the intent of this was to be charging on vehicles that were motorized vehicles, and we'd like to exclude non-motorized vehicles. The second issue that we'd like to talk about is the calculation of the tax on a leased vehicle. So currently, the way the statute is written, the vehicle is sold from a dealer to the leasing company. So at that time, they have to charge the full amount of the vehicle tax. Conversely, we as dealers and the consumers are buying for a shortened period of time, a two-year lease or a three-year lease, but the leasing companies are passing on the full cost of the lease to the consumer at that part end. So what we'd like to do is have that redefined, and we've submitted some language on how we feel it should be written. But I believe, Bill, we sent that to the committee just earlier this week. But we'd like it to be any cap cost reduction, which is if you do money down or trade in a vehicle that lowers the cost of the lease, plus the cost of the monthly lease payments times the number of payments would be what the value that it's charged on, because that's technically what we as dealers are selling and what the consumer is buying. We think that's a more fair method of calculating the tax on a lease rather than a sale. I'd also like to point out that in both Washington and California, when they calculate their sales tax, this is the method that they use to calculate that tax, so we'd like to mirror that. I will tell you that the leasing companies and the DMS systems, which are the data management systems that all the dealers work off of, have really struggled with how they can implement this based on they're actually leasing a vehicle for a set amount. It has a value based on that, but they're having to calculate it on something that is sold to a separate company, so it's not that. So we've struggled with that part, and they keep asking us, can we just do like we do in California? Can we just do like we do in Washington? And again, we just think that's a more fair and equitable way of calculating that. Then the last part of our three issues we wanted to talk about was medium-duty trucks. And again, I brought Don Emerson in to talk about that, but let me start by giving a definition of what a medium-duty truck is. And that is already recognized in statute as a vehicle that's over 10,000 pounds gross vehicle weight. And this current privilege tax excludes anything over 26,000 pounds gross vehicle weight. So we're just talking about the vehicles that are in between that gap. So it's not your Ford F-350 pickup trucks. It's medium-duty trucks like Don has that are Isuzu and Hino-type trucks that fall into that classification. Currently, what he buys from his manufacturer is a cab and a chassis. And then he turns around and contracts on behalf of the purchaser to have a body put on the back of that. And that body could be anything from a flatbed to a tank for a pump truck to a tow truck or a medical unit that gets put on the back of there. And the cost can vary anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 up to $200,000, all of which he turns around and resells to the customer at cost. There is no margin for him on that. So he's being taxed on the full value of the vehicle rather than just the cab and chassis, which is what he purchased and is reselling. That's where his margin is built. So our recommendation is to take the retail value of the vehicle minus the body that's put on there to calculate that tax. And at that point, I'll lob it to Don and let him talk a little bit more in detail about that.
You're welcome, sir.
Well, thank you. Chair McEwen and Mr. Byers, Chair Byers. I want to say I'm new at this.
I will need your name for the record, please.
My name is Don Emerson.
Thank you, sir.
I own FMI Truck Sales and Service. I started talking with Greg about this because medium-duty trucks are very different than cars. You know, where our trucks are sold, like Greg outlined, as a cab and chassis, and they're used in many, many different applications. So we see a huge variation in the same exact vehicle at the total at the end of the cost. Sometimes we do have our customers, they buy their own bodies. Most of them are small businesses that may buy a truck every 5, 6, 7 years. They don't have the expertise. They don't know about what's available. It's very hard for them because they just don't do it very often. So in many cases, we facilitate that for them because they just don't do it on a regular basis, and we do. So I guess what we're asking, as Greg had outlined, is that since we don't make any profit on the back ends of the trucks, it's really just facilitate so we can sell our chassis. If we could eliminate that equipment and pay the tax on, you know, our sale price that includes any profit that we make, no matter where we make it from, at that point, then we believe that the consumer will still get the service that they want. It makes financing the vehicle much easier than if they try to go to a financing source with two different invoices and put them together, or if they have to buy our chassis first, and then it might take six weeks to put a truck together. So they're sitting on that chassis, maybe paid for, that they can't use. So the other alternative for them is, you know, at this point, is to learn about their own body, the truck body that they're going to put on there, no matter what it is, and then make a decision whether they want to buy it in Oregon or go somewhere else and have it put on. So, you know, I guess from our standpoint, all we're really saying is that the cab and chassis we understand, and it's very easy just to look at the invoices and say, okay, the cab and chassis is $50,000, the back end's $70,000, you know, here's how much you should pay the tax on. It doesn't seem fair to me, and, you know, I'm new at this, like I said, but it doesn't seem fair to me that because I happen to be in an industry that requires an $80,000 back end of my chassis, and you're in a business that requires a $2,000 flatbed, that I should pay that much more tax for the same exact vehicle. So what we'd ask again is that we look at the cab and chassis pricing with any profit that the dealer makes as a reasonable solution.
And again, we've submitted language based on how we would phrase that.
I think that's what
yes, Senator Byer.
I was just going to say, I think that's current law, but I think we have DOR in the audience, and I would ask them about that. LC, Legislative Council, thinks that is what the law says.
Well, that is not, it's not spelled out. And again, I'm new at this, but yeah. We are currently charging, or we're currently paying for the complete vehicle. And
I think we have DOR in the audience.
Okay.
We could ask.
Mr. Emerson, I too am under the assumption, the way the bill was drafted, that it is just the vehicle itself and not the add-on that is part of the privilege tax. So if there's some misunderstanding here, I believe we need to clarify that.
Okay.
We did have a conversation that was a little bit different, particularly around additions that have to do with ADA requirements, and I know that's another specific area of the law we did not intend to be wrapped up in this either. So we'll speak to the expert here.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, for the record, Xanne Culver with the Oregon Department of Revenue. And we have interpreted the law to include both the cab and chassis and any modifications to the vehicle. And part of the connection there is with the use tax. there is a specific link to the vehicle at the time it's registered. So it would be the complete vehicle when it's titled and registered with DMV and the value of that.
Clarify that.
And Senator Johnson.
I also am, I have to admit, I'm pretty confused by this whole conversation, but I'm curious that if you eliminate trailers, are you eliminating recreational trailers too? I mean, I'm just kind of lost in this.
Senator, if you don't mind, we might clarify the issue of the mid-weight vehicle and the add-ons, and would you mind if we go back to the trailer?
I'll be just as lost
since
if we
EOR.
Go back, so that's
okay.
Fine.
Senator Boquist.
Okay, so having been in the room, mm-hmm. I can first say that the intent was not to have the chassis. It was the base vehicle only.
That's right.
So if we need to fix the law, that's one thing. Second thing, DOR needs to get together with DOJ and your people and link up with legislative council, because we were just briefed not more than 40 minutes ago the exact opposite of the way the law is written. So there's a confusion between the executive branch's interpretation and the legislative branch right now. So in terms of the original intent of the bill, it was the chassis only. And we just again got briefed by legislative council not more than an hour ago on that. And so if there's a different interpretation and we need to fix the language of that, we need to get DOR immediately, because we're on a time hack here, involved with legislative council and whoever at DOJ has made that interpretation. So,
and Mr. Emerson, I can tell you that I was in the room as well, and the intent was not to do the add-on.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be great. Like I said, I'm just, in fairness to the businesses of Oregon, mm-hmm. and you know, the end users, because if you know, given that there's nothing but an incentive for somebody to get the pack into their truck somewhere else.
Yeah, this was just obviously we have a miscommunication at some point.
And Madam Chair, that should be an easy fix, because just for the record, Legislative Council is watching the tape right now, and the lawyer
Patrick waves
now,
his hands.
Patrick,
they will show
quick
up.
Quick signal. We don't need them to show up, but they just need to make the fix. But that doesn't answer the trailer. Now the trailer question.
Representative McLean.
I can wait until after. Well, I just want to say that if that's possible there, to have two different agencies have two different interpretations. There was something else that you said as far as what kind of calculations you wanted us to do on some of this, which is, you know, make it like California and Washington. There is a difference, I've been told, over the last, you know, year and a half between a use tax and a sales tax, and I don't want us to get into that mirrored, you know, conversation. And so I think it's going to be important for us to clear up the difference again for the purpose that you talked about between a use tax and a sales tax. And the Department of Revenue and the legal folks and everybody else need to be on the same page on that as well. So I just want
this
to put a little old sticker over here reminding us to go back and talk about that.
Representative Vile.
I'm with Senator Boquist on this. It should be just as easy as looking at Section 90A of the enrolled bill and saying a retail vehicle includes this but not that. Done.
Council is feverishly taking notes, right, Council? I have written it down.
Sir, thank you for bringing this to our attention.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Rep. McCune,
yes,
and Senator Boquist, I just want to assure you that we will address this tomorrow with all
early.
The attorneys.
Great. Thank you.
Thank
we
you
appreciate
very much.
That. We appreciate you being here tonight.
Yeah.
Up to trailers. Yes, Senator Johnson.
If I may renew my
yes.
question, I want to know what we're doing with recreational trailers.
Mm-hmm. Representative, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Co-Chair Beyer, and Senator Johnson. Our intent, I think, is a little different than what the Department of Revenue has talked about before, and we would prefer to remove all trailers as defined by 801-560. Now, that's, you know, just our intent, thinking it's a lot easier for us to look at and calculate, but again, it's up to this committee to decide what they feel is in the best interest of moving forward.
I think all trailers are included now, is my understanding.
Correct.
I believe that's correct.
All trailers.
First time they're registered.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the work committees, we had talked about trailers. The enforcement, Bi-Mart sells trailers. Mm-hmm. The trailer houses that are pulled behind. I don't know how we can enforce it and collect it, because you now opened up a can of worms, whether it's a construction trailer. So I thought we had some kind of agreement that we were only going to do motorized vehicles. And I don't know where that happened. But I think from keeping something simple for audit and for people that are paying it, that I would recommend keeping it just as motorized vehicles.
Questions? Department of Revenue, may I ask a question?
Madam Chair?
You're filling out an important bill.
Sorry, Bill. I think the question about how you would collect that, we've had some discussions about at the point of registration, one time for a trailer. Does that, how would that work under your, instead of point of sale, it would be at point of registration. Even though it doesn't have an odometer, you could do a one-time point of registration.
Chair McKeon, members of the committee, for trailers, it would be the privilege tax on the vehicle when it is sold by a dealer. So in the example of Bi-Mart sells trailers, mm-hmm. if Bi-Mart is a licensed dealer, then they would be subject to the privilege tax for that sale. And I did testify to this committee a couple of weeks ago regarding trailers not having an odometer.
Right.
And the alternative of using a manufacturer's certificate of origin or manufacturer's forget what the other
term
is.
The acronym. MS something.
Thank you. Statement of origin. That could be a determining factor that it would be a new trailer because it doesn't have an odometer. We don't have any way to verify the mileage that has traveled on a public highway, and that MCO or MSO is turned into the DMV at time of title and registration.
Question of yours.
Yes.
So Senator, to follow up to that, just like a vehicle and your coordination with DMV, is if a trailer carries over 1,500 pounds in the state of Oregon, I'm looking for someone in ODOT to wake up back there, it has to then be registered. And if it doesn't have the appropriate documentation upon registration, it would then be subject to the same registration fee, not the privilege tax, but the registration fee, as a vehicle would that came in from out of state. Is that not correct?
Chair McKeon, Senator Boquist, yes, every trailer that would be required to be titled in and registered would be subject to the privilege and or use tax.
Right.
How the law is currently written is it applies to all trailers, regardless of whether they're required to be titled and licensed. My understanding is that it's an 1,800-pound gross vehicle weight rating that requires them to be registered. So it is possible to buy a trailer and not put license plates on it, and it's legal to drive it on the road, such as a boat trailer. Mm. It's still subject to the privilege and or use tax under current law.
Madam Chair, at
yes,
some future
Senator
point,
Boquist.
We need to get, and Paul's writing the note down to find out what is that weight. Okay, thank you.
Senator Johnson?
I'm just perplexed.
Representative Vile.
You're speechless for once.
I am.
Well, I'm a little confused, too, because, again, in the enrolled bill, a taxable motor vehicle includes, in Section 89.6.0, a truck trailer, as defined in ORS 801.580. But then when you look at that 801.580, a truck trailer means any trailer designed and used primarily for carrying loads other than passenger, whether designated as a balance trailer, pole trailer, semi-trailer, or self-supporting trailer. So it doesn't seem that there's any limitation whatsoever there. We've got to make sure we've fixed that, or we're going to continue with some real uncertainty in that.
We look forward to your suggestion.
Representative.
Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to clarify that actually in Section 89, it's sub 1, where it references a definition in Chapter 744, I believe, and that definition says trailers. It is very vague.
So, follow up, Madam Chair. So, in Section 6, where we've got that definition for the taxable motor vehicle, which is how we tie the privilege tax, what does it mean when it says a taxable motor vehicle is a new motor vehicle with a gross vehicle weight rating of 26,000 pounds or less? That is a truck trailer as defined in ORS 801-580.
That is one of the many types of vehicles that's subject to the tax.
That A through P in the definition, right?
I apologize. I'm looking.
See, I think these two sections maybe have an internal inconsistency, and I just want to make sure we catch that. We flag it, catch it.
Madam Chair.
Senator DeBoer.
You know, a simple clarification would be, although I'd prefer to ban all trailers, which would be travel trailers and fifth wheels, but if you just clarified that if it's required to be registered with the DMV and it's on an MSO, then the tax would be collected. And that lets out all the other trailers so that don't have to be licensed.
Yeah. That's what I thought. So. Yeah, that makes sense. Exactly.
Thank you, Senator.
Does that?
Any other comments?
Does that work for DOR?
Chair McCune, co-chair Beyer, yes, DOR would be able to administer that.
That make it easier?
We would be able to verify it with DMV more easily, yes.
Maybe a way to do it.
That really does make sense.
Vice Chair Olson.
So the 1,800 pounds. And well, what do you do though with the fixed license plates right now for the fixed trailers?
Need a few, suppose a few dollars.
I mean, some of those are well under 1,800 pounds, but they're designed specifically and it's identified in here for that.
Senator DeBoer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think you have. It's very definite on what you have to register as a trailer, and very definite what you don't. I think it's 1,800 pounds, so I think just adding that wordage takes care of the whole thing and allows DMV to actually monitor it, which would include a boat trailer, by the way, because they have to be licensed.
Any other comments or questions for
this
panel?
Helpful.
I have a
yes.
personal question. Yeah.
Senator Boquist.
So does a boat trailer that's powered have to be licensed? Because, or can you have a boat that's like a sailboat that's not powered?
Well, just the trailer has to be licensed. The boat is licensed through the Marine Division. So you're only talking about the trailer itself.
If it's a powerboat.
No. Made any difference. Trailers. If it exceeds, trailer? I think, the 1,800 pounds, so a little tiny Hobie Cat doesn't have to be licensed.
That's my Hobie Cat. Exactly what I'm asking.
It would not include. So it has to be over at 1,800 pound. I think it clearly makes it easier for DOR.
So probably,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Vile.
So, Senator DeBoer, you said a minute ago you'd prefer if we just didn't deal with the trailers at all. Tell me more about why you think that would be the better route to go.
You bring so many other people that have to pay the tax that may not be aware of it, and I think it makes it harder to monitor. The new car tax is pretty easy in the truck because we're highly regulated. There's a definite number. We have specific dealer location requirements, and we're highly computerized, so it's easy for us. There's a lot of little mom and pop single proprietor that sells travel trailers, and I just think a lot of them are going to miss it. Of course, if they're registering the trailer, that now makes a step that they have to already be licensed with the state to do that. So,
right. Senator
basic
Johnson,
philosophy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sort of moved by the elegance of yes. Senator DeBoer's proposal. For the first time, the light has come on.
Simple. So.
Whatever we can do to help, Senator.
Anyone else?
Madam Chair, can I just wrap up a
yes,
couple
sir.
Of things?
Yes, sir. Please do.
Madam Chair and committee members, I truly appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk about it. I want to go on record as saying I really like Legislative Council's determination of the the medium-duty truck side of it and want to move towards getting that part of it clarified. As we've tried to implement the different aspects of the new privilege tax and use tax, Exan and I have become very good friends because we have so many questions that they have been diving into to try and do it. So we've been going off of what their recommendation is. And again, as I mentioned in the starting point, I was part of, as we were drafting what the intent was and working with this committee as well as the governor's office, that was how I interpreted it not to be. So I think that's important. Secondly, I want to apologize to Representative McLean. I wasn't trying to reference this as a sales tax. That's not what my intent was. I was simply using that as a correlation to say that that is the method that they calculate their sales tax, and if we could do ours in the same manner, it certainly would be congruent. Not, again, not calling it a sales tax, but to be congruent with the way that the other states, surrounding states, calculate it for our process. And I think it would also be easier for Department of Revenue and calculations. And then in final, the trailer side of it, I go with Senator DeBoer's idea. I just think if we look at how much work it would cost for the Department of Revenue to track it down and audit all of those ones that may just miss it and so forth, it's going to be a lot of work. And I think it may just be a very simple, clear method of just taking care of a problem. And I only say that from the standpoint of I truly think that the revenue that was attempted to be collected from this tax to do the two things that it was implemented to do, which was the EV rebate and the charge ahead rebate, will be fully fulfilled by what our sales and revenue will be. With that, I appreciate the time and thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative McLean.
Well, first of all, I appreciate your comment on why you use that term, and I appreciate the clarity that we are talking about privilege tax slash user tax or fee. And I do want to say, though, that I like the senator's idea on his solution on trailers, because your idea of just let's don't do trailers, you know, that to me is something that means that we would be going away from a bill we passed, because the bill that we passed said that we were going to, you know, the terminology that was read to us, the statutes that were there, I want us to stick with what we passed. And so I think the clarity that was brought to us by the definition from the senator makes some sense. But I don't think we should be trying to look for solutions or remedies that are completely not encased in that bill. And there are many other issues that are on the table right now that I think fits into that category. Mm-hmm. And so I want to be clear, I'm going to be looking for the solutions, the fix-it pieces that we believe need to be part of a, you know, of an elegant fix for something that was simply wrong, not worded correctly, not thought about in a way, but we're not changing the policy. This is a policy bill that we already passed.
Thank you, Representative. Any final comments? Yes,
Chairman?
Sir. Mr. Emerson.
I don't do trailers, okay, so, but I do. We do work with a lot of companies that make a lot of bodies. And I will tell you that over the course of the 30 years I've been doing this, there have been a number of those companies during the tough times that started building anything they could to stay alive. And trailers are very natural for somebody who builds a truck body. I would have to agree that I think it would be a complete nightmare trying to keep track of all these little companies that go in and build for a while then come out. You know, the idea of for a trailer paying it at the, you know, when you license it would be the easiest way by far, because we've had a number of customers or suppliers that have gone in and out of that business depending on the economy.
Well, thank you. We appreciate your comments, and we're all learning here. And we'd like you to introduce your daughter, please, while she's here.
My daughter, Madeline Remensberger. She's a freshman at Beaverton High School, and just thought this was a great way to spend her President's Day.
I'll bet.
I think that'll be in the record of the Joint Transportation Committee, and we're delighted to have you
Madam
here tonight.
Chair.
Time to go home and do homework. Representative McLean.
I want to make sure that you know that we all support you. Don't let your dad put words in your mouth. You decide what you want to say, okay?
Senator Johnson has a question here.
Senator
Johnson. I was just
going to
comment that sometimes it must be a little vague in your understanding about what your dad does. But tonight you watched him help make good Oregon law and make a very persuasive case. So you got a pretty good view of what he does when he goes out the door in the morning.
Yeah. Be proud.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, XN.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm a little confused. So,
Let me call Mr. Fuller up while we're having a comment here.
Oh, well, I'm being confused. So we're on such a tight time frame here. When Legislative Council listens to this debate, and we haven't yet actually told them what we wanted to do, whether we wanted to be drafted one way or the other way, how's that going to work when we get a bill back and we haven't been...
Representative Violet, is my hope that by 4 o'clock tomorrow you can, either with your chart or with notes, get to me how you would like to resolve this problem,
okay,
if you would like to weigh in. Because the time is very short, and the drafting time is going to be short, and there will not be a lot of time to go draft a fairly large bill and then come back.
Got it.
So we need your thoughts ASAP.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Chair Beyer.
And if I can add, I remind people that this is not cast in stone. We will be back.
Next
Some
year.
May not like it in about 7 months.
Mr. Fuller, welcome to our committee.
Pardon me, Senator Monroe had his hand up, so yeah. I didn't want to get
it. I apologize, Senator Monroe.
Just to clarify, seems like we have two rational choices with respect to trailers. Either don't tax them at all, or tax them when they're registered. So that, and DMV says, revenue say they can do that. I hesitate not to tax them at all because some of those trailers are immensely valuable. It's very expensive, and do use up a lot of space on the road, and so on. So, at this point, I'm leaning toward tax those that have to be registered and licensed when they're registered and licensed, and if they don't have to be registered and licensed, you don't tax them.
Thank you, Senator. We appreciate your comments. Senator DeBoer, did you have any further comments on that last panel, or should we move on to Mr. Fuller?
No, I think Senator Monroe said it very well.
Chair Beyer.
At the risk of dragging this on too long, I would remind the committee that was the funding source for Connect Oregon.
That's right.
We haven't found another one other than lottery, which we keep spending elsewhere.
Welcome.
Madam and Mr. Chair, Darrell Fuller here this evening on behalf of two separate clients, so I'll deal with them separately. Initially, on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association, the panel that was here just prior to me was the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. They represent the franchise New Car Dealers Association. The Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association represents the independent, smaller used car dealers. And then after I deal with OVDA, I'll testify briefly on behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association. NATA represents mechanical and collision repair shops and dismantlers, and they have a separate issue. So beginning with the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association, the independent dealers, the House Bill 2017 came out of the 2017 session, and then you've had some conversations about it in your previous public hearings, and it has to do with the definition of a new motor vehicle, and as you have it now, as I understand it, a new motor vehicle is a vehicle that has not been titled in Oregon with less than 7,500 miles on it, and that's what concerns us. In that if you are an Idaho resident, you buy a new car, and 3 or 4 months later you move to Oregon, and you now title that Idaho-titled vehicle into Oregon and get an Oregon title for it, and that vehicle has 6,000 miles on it, it is now a new car for the purposes of the tax here in Oregon. So you have a used car that you are paying a new car tax on because you happen to be moving into the state of Oregon. Or if you're a small independent dealership somewhere along the borders of Oregon and Idaho, Washington, or California, and you take in a traded-in vehicle that has 7,000 miles on it, and you turn around and sell that to an Oregon resident, you now as a dealer have to pay a new car tax on a used vehicle. And my concern there is a lot of the smaller independent shops may not realize that they are subject to this tax because they are a used car dealer selling a used car product.
but we have defined a new vehicle as anything with less than 7,500 miles on it. So my encouragement to the committee would be to consider changing that definition of a new motor vehicle to one that has a MSO or an MCO on it, a manufacturer sticker of origin or a manufacturer certificate of origin, because that is truly what a new vehicle is. It is one that has never been titled in any state for use by any individual or organization. Once a vehicle goes out the door, a new vehicle goes out the door, and it belongs to somebody other than the dealer. It is now a used car, even if it only has 20 or 30 miles on it. So on behalf of smaller dealers that aren't paying attention to this because it's a new car tax, I would encourage you to really narrow the definition of what a new car dealer is, or a new car is for the purpose of the tax, to only those with an MSO or an MCO. And so that is my comment on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association on the new car tax. I do think it's interesting as I look at the way this is structured for somebody who's getting this rebate. By the way, they have to live in a certain part of the state in order to qualify for the rebate. They have to have a income that's below a certain threshold in order to qualify to participate in this program. And then they have to have a vehicle that's 20 years old or older that they're willing to trade in. And that's part of it that I think is interesting, because if I'm a dealer and I find a customer who lives in that area and has the income that's below that range, and they're getting ready to buy one of these electrical vehicles from me, but they don't have a 20-year-old car to trade in, as a dealer, I'm going to know where to get them one. I'm going to buy them a broken-down, old, 20-year-old car that's still titled, that's still registered, because the law says it has to be registered continuously for the last 2 years. But it may be up on block someplace that I know I can buy for $300 or $400. I'm going to turn around and sell it to my customer for $1,200, and I'm going to get them a $2,500 rebate on a car that may have never been on the road in the last 2 years. But they've kept it registered. All right, as a dealer, I'm going to go out and I'm going to start finding those cars. So when those customers come in, I know how to get them $2,500, and I'm going to get them a real cheap car and make some extra money out of it. So I think that there could be a cottage industry that you're going to create there that could really be interesting. But that's
what to do with my car.
Yeah. I say this only.
And Mr. Fo, I just want to clarify for the panel that we have two separate rebates available. One's called Charge Ahead. That's the one that Mr. Fuller is talking about. So
and
DEQ
because,
will be here to talk in a minute.
Yeah, my daughter has had a Jeep Liberty, and she was on her way to Klamath Falls to see my parents when the engine blew up. It spun a bearing. I don't know what spun a bearing means, but my repair shop in Klamath Falls that my parents use and the repair shop here in Salem that I use both spun a bearing. Says it defines the vehicle as scrap metal. But it was still registered here in the state of Oregon. I sold it to a dismantler for a few hundred dollars, and it was gone. But with this program, I could have held onto that vehicle, and it could have been valued up to $2,500 to somebody who could have used it. So maybe I could have found somebody that paid $1,500 or $200 or $2,000 for it for me, because they could turn it around and turn it in to be a part of this program. That's neither here nor there. I just thought that was an interesting enterprise that may happen.
This was not a portion of the bill that we liked.
So again, on behalf of OVDA, I would strongly encourage you to reduce the definition of a new vehicle to only that with an MSO or MCO. On behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association, which is the dismantlers, and I'm here on behalf of the dismantlers, there was some confusion in the language in House Bill 2017, and the confusion was in two different portions of the statute as it's currently constituted. It uses two different phrases. In one of the phrases, it says that the customer who's turning in a 20-year-old vehicle that would voluntarily retire or scrap. And then in the next page, it says document that the person will scrap or otherwise render inoperable. And so that was my question at the end of last session. What do we mean by voluntarily retire or scrap versus will scrap or otherwise render inoperable? Because retiring a vehicle and scrapping a vehicle can be two very different things. In our opinion, on behalf of an industry that recycles vehicles, which is recycling is a good thing, right? We like the notion that if the vehicle is taken off the road and can never be registered again as a vehicle to be on the road, well, then it has been retired. It will never be a vehicle for use on the public roads again. At that point, it is retired, but the vehicle is available for recycling purposes. In other words, a dismantler could take that vehicle into inventory and sell the parts of it for other vehicles. Mm-hmm. Now, the rules being written by Department of Environmental Quality and some of the discussions you're having will require the vehicle to be rendered completely inoperable. And they do that by destroying the engine. You pour what they call liquid glass or something into the, and you run the engine until it essentially becomes inoperable again. The value of the vehicle, once you've destroyed the recycle value of the engine, then the value of the vehicle becomes practically nothing.
Staying out of this fight.
And a dismantler at that point isn't going to want to buy it from the dealer that takes it in on trade. Then it no longer had, because a vehicle at a dismantler's shop, it takes up space, and they've only got so much space for so many vehicles. So if the vehicle has almost no value, if all they can sell off of it is a door panel, or especially when you're talking about a 20-year-old vehicle, most of my dismantlers are saying, if you render the engine useless to us, then we're not going to be interested in buying these vehicles at all. Which means the vehicles then have even less value and fewer places to take them in terms of recycling purposes. So it is not a big deal to us, other than you're going to limit the number of places where these vehicles can go once they're turned in if you render the engine completely inoperable. And so we just encourage you to keep that in mind. We like recycling all of the vehicle, and if we can't recycle all of the vehicle, we probably won't have any interest in buying them. So,
thank you,
and with
Mr.
that,
Cole.
I'd be happy to answer any questions on either one of those things.
Senator Girod.
The question I have is back to your new car definition that you like. Mm-hmm. Would a demo vehicle still fall as a new car?
If it has not been, Mr. Chair, Senator Girod, if the vehicle has not been sold to a customer, if it has not been titled, then yeah, a demo car, and I would defer to Senator Boer if I'm not correct, but it depends on how many miles and what the demo car is used for. And I think that's part of the reason why the 7,500 miles in there, if I remember my conversations with Senator Lord correctly, there are times that a dealership will title a car to itself, right, and use that vehicle as a demo. And then if it has less than 7,500 miles on it, they can resell it with all of the new car warranties and rebates on it, even though it's been titled in Oregon to the dealership. Am I close to correct on that, Senator DeBoer? So, pardon me. So they like the 7,500 mile number comes in there when a dealer registers titles a vehicle to itself. And if they wanted to protect that interest for the new car dealers to title some vehicles to themselves that they use as loaners or demos, then I would encourage you to write the definition, the 7,500 miles or less. If you're going to keep that as part of the definition of a new car, then I would limit the 7,500 miles to a vehicle that's been titled in the name of the dealership, because then you're only dealing with the cars that they purchase themselves that then still qualify for all of the new car warranties and stuff, but you're not dealing with the consumer that is trading in a vehicle with 6,000 miles on it that is now subject to the tax because it happens to be a low mileage vehicle, and they're stuck paying a new car tax on a used car. Does that make sense, or did that confuse it?
Senator Johnson?
I want to go back into an earlier comment that you made, and that is about the socioeconomics of some of the people that are dealing in these cars. I'm trying to figure out, in all of the detail that you went into, when we're talking about folks that are trading back and forth through a dealer or just private sales, extremely high mileage vehicles that may be deemed by some as high emission or, you know, bad cars. I got a little lost in the details that you were laying out. I want to make sure that we don't eliminate the ability for people who are not in the market for new cars, not in the market for electric vehicles, not in the market for anything other than one old clunker for another old clunker in somebody's definition of what a clunker might be. Do you see any problems in any of your description about the market in these older, higher mileage vehicles?
Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, this isn't going to affect the market for older vehicles, except that to the degree that this program is successful, It will take older high mileage vehicles out of the marketplace. There will be fewer of them available for low-income people that maybe can't afford anything else. So if the program is incredibly successful, then low-income people will have a harder time finding a vehicle that they can afford. And I mean, there'll just be fewer of them available, and as a result, the prices of them could incrementally increase. Does that get to the question you're asking?
That gets to my question. No. I think in all of the details that we're involved in writing this bill, the practical application of who can afford to buy what where and how limited that market is or not limited that market is, I think all of us want the higher emission cars out of service, but for certain price points, that's all that might be available. And I'm just was seeking your comment on what happens to the available inventory of those older, higher emission cars in the context of the comments you made.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Chair, and I think you're right. I mean, again, if the program is successful, every one of those cars that gets traded in for this purpose is one less car that's going to be available for a low-income person to purchase, because the car is going to be either retired out of the inventory or completely rendered inoperable, which means if you have one of those older vehicles and the engine breaks down, you may not even be able to get the parts to repair it, because we're going to render that engine inoperable, which means it won't be available even at the junkyard to be used to repair other vehicles. One of the things that I did find interesting is, as I was talking with my clients on sort of who qualifies for this, again, you have to live in a certain part of the state, you have to have a certain income, you have to have a car that's over 20 years old, you got to be willing to buy a zero emissions vehicles, and most of those are fairly expensive vehicles, and if you're a low income person with a car that's 20 years older or older, the likelihood that you're going to have the credit score you need to buy an expensive zero emissions vehicle, I think, continues to limit the pool, where I think we're going to have a relatively small pool of people that qualify for this program at all, because there's so many boxes that they have to fill in order to qualify for any of these rebates.
Senator DeBoer.
Madam Chair, I think DEQ probably has some information that will help when we get to that portion,
they're
so I would
next.
Move on.
Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any more questions for Mr. Fuller? Thank you, sir.
Thank you for indulging with your time.
Let's see. Ms. Koch, Jeanette Shaw, and John Jensen, I believe. Jensen?
Four. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you for being here. We appreciate your time. Welcome. In any order you choose.
Good evening, Madam Chair, Co-Chair Beyer, members of the Transportation Committee, and Senator DeBoer. My name is Jeanette Shaw, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs with Forth. And I'm feeling remiss I did not bring my teens here tonight. I have a 16-year-old and an 18-year-old, and I'm sure they would have wanted to be here. But
and you can play them the tape.
Once I get home, I certainly, or tomorrow, will do that. Thank you. But as I'm sure you all are aware, Forth is a trade association that promotes transportation electrification. We're headquartered here in Oregon, and we have the distinction of opening the nation's first and only neutral electric brand car mobility showcase in downtown Portland, and I invite you all to come down. If you haven't test driven an electric vehicle, we have the ability to have you test drive for free. We support the electric car changes as currently written in HB 4060, provided to you all. And we also agree upon DEQs, and you'll be hearing from Matt here shortly, with regards to electric vehicle rules advisory committee stakeholders. We do not support any new amendments to HB 4060 that has already not been discussed, and we support the funding source of the rebate. For brevity and sake of time, I'm just going to skip a few points. Have some facts. Electric cars can be still expensive, though they are coming down substantially in price. They are available for moderate and low-income individuals to purchase, and with currently over 20 states with electric vehicle rebates, such as California, Colorado, Connecticut, Idaho, New York, they are becoming much more affordable. One stat that we found of interest is, according to the Center for Sustainable Energy, well over 70% of the respondents said that state rebates were either extremely or very important in making it possible for them to acquire an electric car. Similarly, surveys have shown that if you remove a rebate, such as Georgia did, you'll see a precipitous drop-off of electric vehicle purchases and a shift back to conventional cars. Given these stats, electric vehicles are a proven approach to substantially increasing and ensuring that the purchase of EVs can be done. Another interesting stat that leases constitute approximately 80% of all fully electric car drivers' leases that are purchased. So 80% of fully electric car leases have been leased. Also, 55% of plug-in hybrids are leased. So 80% leased, 55% leased. So you see a very high number of leases occurring. Mm-hmm. And for as little as $45 per month, an individual can actually lease an electric car. I have a colleague who actually did so. And this is oftentimes less than a phone bill per month. So it does make it more affordable, and it's becoming more affordable for low-income moderate consumers. Lastly, the rebate is appropriately targeted towards potential owners who need that incentive the most. In addition to the environmental benefits, which you'll hear about, electric cars are actually cheaper to own and operate and can save Oregonians hundreds of dollars per month in fuel and maintenance costs. And I know we've met with you each before to discuss that. With its rebate on the manufacturer vehicle's retail price, we offer additional rebate program exclusively available to low and moderate income customers. And the rebate includes additional pilot program that is assisting disadvantaged. All in all, it's a program that certainly will help get those who are low and moderate income into electric vehicles. We respectfully request the passage of HB 4060 as written, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Chair McKeown, members of the committee, I'm Angela Crowley Cook, Legislative Director of Oregon Environmental Council. Oregon Environmental Council supports HB 4060 with the electric vehicle fixes as currently written. The electric vehicle rebate program created in the HB 2017 last session is of utmost importance to improve our air quality and our climate. Oregon is substantially behind in meeting our greenhouse gas reduction goals, and the biggest problem is our transportation sector, which is responsible for almost 40% of the state's emissions. The electric vehicle fixes in HB 4060 were carefully developed, vetted, and improved upon by DEQ's Rules Advisory Committee, and we were involved in that committee. It was made up of policy experts and stakeholders from the auto industry, equity groups, environmental organizations, and public utilities. As a member of that group, we support the following consensus agreements that were reached by the committee and are reflected in the current bill. I'll highlight just a few of them that are especially important. So while the air quality focus is important, the requirements in the Charge Ahead program to scrap the older vehicle should be changed to give DEQ the discretion to determine whether or not that should be a requirement. At this point, it's better to not to have additional requirements for those low and moderate income households so that the benefits can be made as widely available as possible. And then there are other issues that we just heard about tonight, which reinforces that opinion. Additionally, the requirement for DEQ to conduct specific outreach in these communities, as well as a minimum 10% set aside of rebate funds for the Charge Ahead program, must be retained. It's important that the 24-month leases qualify for the same rebate as vehicle purchases, for the reasons that Jeanette mentioned earlier. And lastly, low and moderate income households that qualify for the Charge Ahead program should be able to combine the Charge Ahead rebate with the regular electric vehicle rebate so that purchasing the vehicle is a viable option for people at all income levels. The changes to the electric vehicle rebate program detailed in HB 4060 will only make the program better and easier to use. Thanks very much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I don't know whether or not we priced this or if you know, but the outreach that you're advocating for by DEQ, do we have a price on that? The reason I ask is I just sat through an audit committee meeting that was pretty critical of some of DEQ's timelines and activities, and I'm just wondering, do we have a price or do we know how many people it would take to do the kind of outreach that you're advocating?
Can I phone a friend? I think
they're behind you and they're going to
testify.
They'll
be coming up.
They're going
to come up.
Oh, well.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm happy to answer that, Madam Chair and Co-Chair Beyer. There is a percentage that cannot be spent above, and I believe, and Matt can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's 10% of the overall funds. Currently, right now, they have two individuals who have been hired. They would be looking to source the actual, some of the program development to third parties, being both nonprofit entities. And so the goal of the program is to keep the administrative costs as low as possible so more money goes back to the actual rebates.
I still would like DEQ to provide some specificity because mm-hmm. whether you're doing it in-house or you're sourcing it out, somebody's getting paid and it's going to cost something.
Correct. And I believe there's stipulations of what can and can't be spent in the bill, but I'll let Matt address that. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair McKeon, Chair Beyer, and members of the committee. My name is John Jensen. I'm here as a journeyman electrician wireman and also representing over 4,000 other electrical workers in IBEW Local 48. We're very excited about the coming transition to the electrification of our transportation industry. We have many of our workers have already had specialized training in this. I want to add to what was said here and just said we feel like this is a very timely rebate. We feel that getting more of these cars on the road will help some of the things, like we're still trying to figure out where it's appropriate to site these charging stations and where all we're going to need this infrastructure. So that the quicker we get on this, we feel the better prepared we'll be for this transition. The only other thing I wanted to do is just take a second and thank you all for your late nights and all your work on this. Mm-hmm. Really appreciate everything you're doing on this bill. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And next we have batting cleanup. Matt Davis and Annalisa Grunwald, please, from DEQ. And thank you for your late night. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Joint Committee. For the record, my name is Annalisa Grunwald. I'm the Senior Legislative Advisor for the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm joined today by Matt Davis, our Senior Policy Analyst for Air Quality. I'm sure you're all familiar with Matt. You've seen him a couple times. I'm going to briefly describe the vehicle programs, the vehicle rebate programs as established by House Bill 2017, and then Matt's going to walk the committee through some of the changes that have been touched on so far today. House Bill 2017 directed DEQ to implement, as the Madam Chair said, two new electric vehicle rebate programs. These programs are funded by the privilege tax you've heard about tonight, and the bill directed a maximum of $24 million in this tax revenue per biennium towards these rebate programs. Both programs are set to sunset right now on January 2nd, 2024. The first rebate is for the purchase or lease of new electric vehicles. The amounts for this rebate range between $1,500 and $2,500, depending on the particular vehicle's battery capacity. That those rebates are only eligible for vehicles with an MSRP of $50,000 or less. The second rebate, known as a vehicle charge ahead program or rebate, is for the purchase or lease of new or used electric vehicles. And is specifically set in statute as being between $1,250 and $2,500. Only low and moderate income households are eligible for the second rebate. The charge ahead rebate has additional eligibility requirements that Matt is going to go into now.
Great. Thanks, Annalisa. Good evening, Chair McKeon, members of the committee. My name is Matt Davis, Senior Legislative Analyst with DEQ. So, I think, as you've heard some of the folks tonight allude to, DEQ initiated a rulemaking after the passage of House Bill 2017 to develop all the rules necessary to implement the electric vehicle rebate programs. At that time, the stakeholders actually spent a lot of their time talking about the bill, not necessarily the rules that DEQ had to develop. And in the course of those conversations, they really dug into the eligibility requirements around the charge ahead rebate, the rebate for low or moderate income families. So as you'll recall, the original legislation really had four criteria that had to be met. You had to be low or moderate income, which the statute defined as up to 120% of the median family income of the area where the purchaser lived. You had to use the rebate on a qualifying vehicle. You had to scrap or render inoperable, depending on which section of the bill you were reading, a high emission passenger vehicle, which was defined as 20 years or older, and you had to live in the area of the state defined as having higher than average air pollution from mobile sources or motor vehicles. So in the, again, in the course of that conversation, I think people recognize the intention of the latter two criteria, that you would get an air quality co-benefit from the program. But most folks agreed that that those additional criteria may end up working against the primary goal of the program, which is just to, you know, increase access to electric vehicles for low and moderate income families. So we agreed, the committee kind of expressed interest in removing those two criteria from the program, so that really the only criteria is that you're low or moderate income. We agreed to take that recommendation forward to the legislature, and that's what you see reflected in House Bill 4060. So those criteria that you have to scrap an older vehicle or live in a certain part of the state have been moved from a section of the bill that lays out requirements to a section of the bill that lists things the department may consider. I could tell you now that based on the stakeholder input, we would propose rules that would not include that criteria. So we would not require scrappage or that someone live in a particular area of the state to access the rebate. A couple of other amendments I'd point to that are found in 4060. The first is that most sections of the bill talked about purchases and leases, except the definition, so it cleans up the definitions to make clear that the rebates can be used on purchases and leases. And then finally, the bill talks about those circumstances where the department could claw back a rebate. So essentially, someone has to keep the electric vehicle registered for 24 months following accessing the rebate. And the original statute talked about if someone intended to sell their vehicle or intended to terminate the lease, then they would have to return their rebate. The recommendation from DOJ was that intentions don't matter so much as the actual act of selling the car or terminating the lease before the 24 months. So the bill cleans that up a bit to better reflect that. I think while I'm talking, I'll address Senator Johnson's question about outreach. So sections of the bill related to the Charge Ahead program do require the department to perform some level of outreach about the availability of those rebates. The department's intention is to contract out administration of the program, and that would include the outreach specific to Charge Ahead rebates. I can't give you at this moment an exact figure of how much that might cost because we'll run a competitive bidding process, but I'm happy to come back to you when we have official figures. The bill does stipulate that at least 10% of the bill must be spent on Charge Ahead rebates, but no more than 10% of available revenue be spent on program administration costs, and that would include what we would contract out in terms of outreach. So I can tell you for certain that it wouldn't exceed 10% of the money DEQ is given to implement the program, and I'm happy to follow up with a more definitive figure.
Questions? Yes, Senator Boquist.
Who's going to define scrapping at DEQ?
Chairman Kuhn, Senator Boquist. So I also should have mentioned that the other bill you're considering, House Bill 4059, made both sections read the same, and I believe we can ask LC, but I believe that's render inoperable, and that could be defined through rulemaking. I would note that we have a similar definition in our program that gives out incentives to replace older diesel engines, and the path that most owners take in that program is to drill a hole in the engine block, which preserves most if not all of the other kind of pieces of the vehicle for recycling or reuse or you know selling for some other purpose, but that you're just ensuring that the engine isn't going to be operable.
Senator Johnson.
How much money are we going to spend auditing that or checking it out? I mean, I'm worried about it. Does rend inoperable mean take the keys out of the ignition and put them in my pocket? Or does it mean drill a hole in the block and somebody then has to come out and see that I've complied? I'm just wondering what kind of an administrative hole we're digging for ourselves.
So, Co-Chair McKeon, Senator Johnson, I would point again that House Bill 4060 would have us not scrapping cars, and that's really what we're here recommending tonight, is that the program not require vehicles to be scrapped.
What's in the language? I don't know.
Senator Monroe.
I like that. I don't like scrapping cars. I think it gets us into a lot of trouble. There are families that the only kind of vehicle they can afford is a $200 junker. It still runs, and it still gets them from one place to another. I really don't think we gain much in terms of the number of electric vehicles on the road with this program. Making income level the only criteria really for determining makes sense to me.
Thank you, Senator. Senator DeBoer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the work group, I mean, the scrapping the cars shouldn't be done. It just creates it. And if you do, you don't want to drill a hole in the block. It's terribly hard. We pour liquid glass into the car, put the throttle down till the engine fries. And we've done that in the federal program, which was, so we don't ever drill a hole in the block. It's really hard to do. The 24-month clawback that I think you referred to, I don't know how you enforce that. Some people trade the car or for some reason get rid of the car. Once the tax, the rebate's been paid, I don't know how you're going to enforce taking it back. So I have some concern with that. The other thing is on page 22, line 40, just want to drop the word nonprofit. So when you're bidding, there's only a few nonprofits that would bid on this procedure. We think we have a company that'll do it for free. They are a for-profit. They're licensed with DMV. So if you're going to bid, leave profit and non-for-profit and take the lowest bid you get. So just drop the word nonprofit.
I like that. Madam Chair. I just want to clarify for the record.
Yes, Vice Chair Boquist.
Just to clarify for the record, what you're recommending is that we eliminate scrapping, period, right?
What I would, I'm walking.
You all, your work group.
Excuse me, Chairman McKeon, Senator Boquist. What the work group recommended is that scrappage not be a statutory requirement to access the rebate, but that it live on in statute if later down the road stakeholders want to further refine how the rebates are used. And that's what House Bill 4060 does. That's why it's not removed completely from the statute, but instead moved to a section that makes it permissive. In other words, the Environmental Quality Commission could at a later time require that, but that in statute it is not required to access the charge ahead rebate.
Correct, it has May on it.
Yes.
Of course, the other option, Matt, would be we could just take it out, and if at a later time it made sense, the legislature could put it back in.
I'm with him. I'm with Rod and him.
Chairman McKeon, Co-Chair Beyer, that is absolutely your prerogative.
Questions? Any other questions?
Let's do
for
that.
The comments.
All right, that's what I'm doing.
We're going to wrap it up. All right.
Cool.
Vice Chair Olson, we're just getting ready to wrap this up. Did you have any questions for this panel?
No. Thank you, though.
Thank you very much for being here tonight on a holiday. Is there anyone else here that would like to speak to either one of these two issues that did not sign up? All right. Well, then, unless there's anything for the good of the order, yes.
Madam Chair, just Daryl Fuller brought up the thing on the new car. I would leave it as is. I would maybe say that the tax will only be paid once on a car. The clarification of the 7,500 miles, I don't think we came to a resolution, but I think as it's written, I think we understand the tax will only be paid once on a car.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir. All right. Well, unless there's anything for the good of the order, Senator Johnson, did you have a comment?
My only curiosity is, as we are continuing to winnow, just reiterate, if you would, what the plan is. We'll get to a point where there's general agreement that something is in or out, or we're going to take votes on these individual things, or I'm just trying to figure out what the winnowing process looks like.
Senator, as of about 4:30 today, With Patrick sending out, make sure the designation is correct. The one with section 58 at the bottom is the most current.
Madam Chair, I sent one that has today's date on the top.
Okay. So you have
by
a new,
email, that's the one that...
You have a new clean copy. It would be helpful to us if you could have that back with your markups by 4 o'clock tomorrow.
To your co-chair.
To your chair. You said... And then we will have Patrick go through, and winnow is a very good word, thank you. Take out what we have all agreed on is either the fix-it bill is ready to go, not done, there's a thumbs up. If there are things you have questions about, you need to know that. If there are things you absolutely do not want to consider, we should know that as well. We will go through then and make a run at another draft of this. And then Wednesday, we will go through those pieces. That's the plan at this point.
Okay, the only thing that's missing for me is that you'll make a run at it. Will you start eliminating? Or so eventually we're down to one page or something of the like.
Chair Beyer and then Vice Chair Boquist.
Yes, that's the intent exactly is, as we started out, said if there's major disagreement on anything, it will come off the list.
Okay.
That's the intent. Recognizing again that we're back here in not too far distant future, and this thing is, as all major legislation is an evolving piece. There are a number of things that have been suggested that, as the chairs looked at, we thought we don't need to do it now. We can wait and do it in January. So you're going to see a clean copy on Wednesday.
Winnowed.
And we will go winnowed copy on Wednesday, and we will then go through that and see if, you know, if it meets with the committee's major approval, and from that then will be drafted the final draft.
Mr. Chair, if I might add, to the greatest extent possible, anything that's on that winnowed down list will be in amendment form. To the extent that Legislative Council has the ability to get them done by Wednesday, you'll be able to see the final language for all of those sections as much as possible, so that you'll have an idea of what it'll look like in a final amendment. And it'll be a final amendment to House Bill 4059 is what it becomes. That's the base bill. Is that what I understand, Madam Chair?
That's
the base bill being the technical fix bill. So what it'll be is the things in 4059 and then an amendment of things from 4060 and, well, from that list into 4059.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I don't think there was a request to use the tax on a leased vehicle at a different formula than the sale price. I don't know if anybody ever talked about that, so I'd recommend that we use the...
Was that in the letter that you handed out?
It is, so you can look at it and decide whichever.
Thank you very much. All right, we're adjourned.